where they're coming from down there. Okay. Can I start here? Our next speaker is Adrienne Hercek from Caltech, and she's going to tell us about the inflationary origin of the cosmic power asymmetry.
Okay, thanks for the invitation to be here today. I'll be talking about a strange feature in the cosmic microwave background, the hemispherical power asymmetry, and testing the notion that we could maybe use this asymmetry as a signature of structure that's lying beyond our cosmological horizon. This is work I've done in the past year with Sean and Mark at Caltech, and all the details are in two PRD articles. So I'll start with just talking about the power asymmetry itself and the observational evidence for it, and the basic idea of how we're going to go about making one. That will lead to a bit of a segue about superhorizon perturbations in the CMB and what the direct constraints are on superhorizon structure from the homogeneity of the cosmic microwave background. And then finally, that will lead us to some bad news for our original model. And I'll talk about an alternative scenario, the curvaton model of inflation, and how we can use this model to fix what went wrong with the inflaton model. So what I mean by a hemispherical power asymmetry is the idea that we can treat the cosmic microwave background temperature map as a Gaussian field with isotropic power multiplied by a dipolar modulation, shown here. And what that does is it takes an isotropic Gaussian random field and makes it asymmetric with a higher fluctuation amplitude on one side of the sky than the other. Now, this is a rather extreme example of a 50% modulation. What's actually observed in the data is more of a 10% modulation. You can see it's much more difficult to see with the naked eye. However, a team at JPL back in 2004 did find that there is an asymmetry in the cosmic microwave background. They found it on large scales. And basically, it's that this half of the sky here is smoother on average than this half of the sky. So the power asymmetry is maximized when the hemispheres are divided by a plane that's tilted with respect to the galaxy. And less than 1% of simulated symmetric maps generate this much power asymmetry. So it's about a 99% confidence detection. This asymmetry is also present in the WMAP3 data. This time they fit for this parameter A that measures the dipolar modulation. And they found that the most likely value for A was not zero, but rather at about 0.12. And this showed up in all the different frequency bands in WMAP at about the same level. And this is inconsistent with an isotropic map, again, at about the 1% level. It's very difficult to explain this asymmetry with foregrounds because it's present in all colors, as you can see here, and it's not aligned with the galaxy, as I mentioned before. It's also very difficult to explain it with systematics because not only is WMAP a very well-behaved and well-understood satellite, but also this was detected by COBE, albeit at less statistical significance. So the basic idea of how we wanted to interpret this power asymmetry was as a signature of statistical inhomogeneity. So in the standard picture of inflation that Claudia reviewed for us, the inflaton is basically this homogeneous across what will become our observable universe, but it picks up quantum fluctuations that become the perturbations in the CMB. Now, the key is that the amplitude of these fluctuations is determined by the background value of the inflaton field itself. And so our idea was to create a power asymmetry by introducing a superhorizon fluctuation in the inflaton field that would change the mean value on this side of the sky as opposed to that side of the sky and change the amplitude of the fluctuations. Now, the best fit modulation amplitude is 12%, as I mentioned before, and that means a power asymmetry of plus or minus 20% in opposite directions on the sky. And generating this much asymmetry is going to require a really, really big superhorizon perturbation that we've nicknamed the supermode. And there's two ways of seeing why that's the case. In standard inflation, perturbations with different wavelengths are very weakly coupled. Another way of seeing this is that the fluctuation power just isn't very sensitive to the background value of the inflaton field. In fact, if you calculate the power asymmetry you get by introducing variation in the inflaton field across our universe, you see it's suppressed by a factor of 1 minus n sub s. And as we learned from Claudia's review, n sub s is measured to be very, very close to 1. And so the fear is that this big of a superhorizon fluctuation in the inflaton field is going to generate an equally big potential fluctuation in the gravitational potential, which is also going to lead to a really big temperature anisotropy in the cosmic microwave background. In particular, we worry about the CMB dipole, that surely the dipole created by this would be too large to agree with observations. So that leads me to this second part of superhorizon perturbations in the cosmic microwave background. What are the constraints? I mentioned the dipole. The thing is, the dipole sometimes cancels. It's been known since the late 70s that in an Einstein de Sitter universe that contains only matter, a superhorizon perturbation induces no CMB dipole. And what happens is that the Sachs-Wolfe dipole that comes from the gravitational redshifts of the photons is exactly canceled by our motion due to the superhorizon perturbation that blue shifts the photon that was redshifted by the fact it had to climb out of the well. However, if there's radiation or a cosmological constant, this cancellation is no longer perfect because the Doppler dipole is reduced relative to the Sachs-Wolfe effect. However, you also pick up an integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect that can come into play. And so we calculated, will the superhorizon perturbation induce a CMB dipole in our lambda CDM universe? Yeah.
And gravitational feet, and you go to the free falling frame, and you don't see any field at all.
So you can't get rid of the actual perturbation itself, because we're always working in conformal Newtonian gauge. The gauge is perfectly specified.
Well, that's one gauge, but
and another gauge, yes, you can go to a gauge where the deviations from Friedman-Robertson-Walker are pushed up to order k squared. And that could be also seen as an indication that this you'd expect this linear term to cancel as it does. And so yes, the dipole does cancel in our if you include radiation and the cosmological constant. What I've plotted here is delta 1, which includes all these three effects for a superhorizon perturbation. And what you find is the Sachs-Wolfe and the Doppler effect is always exactly canceled by the integrated Sachs-Wolfe effect. With radiation, without radiation, no matter what the value of omega matter or the redshift of matter radiation equality or the decoupling redshift is, these contributions always cancel, which I think hints is a deeper reason. After we saw this, we started thinking about that. So we don't have to worry about a dipole at all for a flat. As long as we live in a flat lambda CDM universe, the dipole is at absolutely no concern. So going beyond the dipole, and now treating our superhorizon perturbation as a sine wave at which our position is determined by a specific phase, we can expand the produced temperature anisotropy in powers of k dot x, where x is the distance to the surface of last scattering. We've seen that the linear term goes away, but we still have a quadratic and a cubic term that are going to lead to quadrupole and octupole anisotropies. And when we decompose the temperature field into multiple moments, we do find a quadrupole that's proportional to kx squared and an octupole that's proportional to kx cubed. So we have to worry about these constraints. Now remember how we got here and why we care about this. We wanted to create a superhorizon fluctuation in the inflaton field to create our power asymmetry. But we were worried about the resulting temperature anisotropies through the gravitational potential. So the quantity that we really need to constrain is this delta psi, variation in the potential across our observable universe. So we look at the quadrupole first. And the upper bound on delta psi from the quadrupole comes from the maximum allowed A20 moment in the frame aligned with the asymmetry. And we take as a conservative upper bound 3 times the measured variance. Now, the key thing about this constraint is it depends on the sign of the phase of our location. So if we're willing to put ourselves at the zero point of the sine wave, we can evade the quadrupole constraint completely. in which case we have to worry about the octopole. The octopole comes in, again, being set by an upper bound by the octopole moment in the frame measured by the asymmetry. And the key difference here is now delta psi and the octopole have the same phase dependence. So the constraint is independent of phase. You could hope that you could evade this constraint by just decreasing kx, stretching the wave out. But if you do that, eventually your perturbation is going to go nonlinear outside your horizon somewhere. And we didn't want to do that. We wanted this to be a perturbation, not a signature bizarre nonlinear structure lurking outside of our horizon. And when you impose that constraint, you get another bound on delta psi that we've combined with our first bound gives you a hard and fast upper bound on the variation of potential across our observable universe of about 0.1. Now that translates directly into an upper bound on the possible power asymmetry that could be created from this model. It's about 1%. And remember that the observed asymmetry is 20%. So a superhorizon fluctuation in the inflaton field cannot explain this asymmetry. It would just have to be too large. So the final part of my talk is the solution. How do we get this power asymmetry by going to an alternative model, the curvatar model? So what went wrong with the inflaton proposal was actually twofold. First, we had the fact that the inflaton was only weakly dependent on the background value of the inflaton field. And that meant that a small power asymmetry of 20% required a really, really big fluctuation in the inflaton field. The second problem was that since the inflaton dominates the energy density in the universe, a superhorizon fluctuation in the inflaton field created a very, very large superhorizon potential perturbation that was ruled out directly by the CMB octopole with absolutely no flexibility. The solution is to postulate that the primordial fluctuations were not generated by the inflaton field, but rather by a subdominant scalar field, the curvaton. And we'll see that this helps us in two ways. First of all, in this model, the fluctuation power is much more strongly dependent on the background value of the curvaton field. And second, the CMB constraints on delta psi do not directly constrain the power asymmetry. We have a new free parameter in this model, which is the fraction of energy in the curvaton. So a brief, quick review of the curvaton model. It's been around for over 10 years now. Originally proposed to save some favorite inflationary potentials from demise from WMAP data. In the curvaton model, the inflaton still dominates the energy density during inflation, and it's driving the accelerated expansion. The curvaton is a spectator field with a very light mass and a very small energy density. Now, both the curvaton and the inflaton pick up quantum fluctuations during inflation. And after inflation, when the inflaton decays into radiation, the curvaton remains frozen at its value as long as its mass remains small compared to the Hubble parameter. Eventually, the Hubble parameter does decrease to be comparable to the mass, and the curvaton begins to oscillate in its potential well. Finally, still in the very early universe, the curvaton decays into radiation. The key is that between the end of inflation and the decay of the curvaton, the curvaton's energy density is redshifting away less quickly than the radiation energy density. And that means that the fractional energy density in the curvaton is growing. And that growth leads to the generation of curvature perturbations from the curvaton field. And so the curvature perturbation you pick up is related to the density fluctuation in the curvaton field times this parameter R, which is the rate, the fraction of the energy in the curvaton just at the moment of its decay. And we're going to assume that R remains much, much less than 1, because we want to keep the curvaton subdominant. Now, the curvaton energy just comes from its simple potential. So we end up with a simple expression for the density fluctuation. You get those quantum fluctuations from inflation, and that gives you a spectrum of potential fluctuations that depends on the background value of the curvaton field. In fact, because of the way R depends on the curvaton field, this dependence on the background value is actually quite strong. And so we see where our asymmetry is going to come from. We're going to introduce a superhorizon fluctuation in the curvaton field now, and that will change the background value and lead to a power asymmetry. And the key difference here is notice there's no factor of 1 minus n sub s. There's no suppression by the flatness of the spectrum. Now, we still have to worry about the impact this superhorizon fluctuation will have on the CMB. And a sinusoidal fluctuation in the curvaton will still give a large potential fluctuation, but it's different from the inflaton case in two important respects. First of all, it's suppressed by this factor of R. And second, we started off with a sinusoidal fluctuation in sigma. Because of this quadratic term, the potential fluctuation is not sinusoidal. And what that means is that when we consider the temperature anisotropy, we look at the quadrupole and octupole terms, these no longer have simple dependencies on the phase of our location. It's more complicated. And if we look at a specific supermode, something comparable to what we're going to need to generate the asymmetry, we can see that the constraints on R depend on the phase. The regions in red are ruled out by the quadrupole, and they're usually the strongest constraint, except at these sweet spots where the octupole is the strongest constraint. We're going to take as our fiducial value just the phase being 0, because this is a pretty representative upper bound on R. And that translates into an upper bound on R times the fluctuation in sigma. The key difference here is that this ratio determines the power asymmetry. So now we have this free parameter R to use to make sure we evade the quadrupole constraint. The other free parameter in our model is the perturbation mixture. Remember that both the inflaton and the curvaton pick up quantum fluctuations during inflation. But the mechanisms by which those quantum fluctuations become curvature fluctuations are very, very different. We've already seen how this is grown from an oscillating curvaton field. This comes through the usual formulation. And you see that this one depends on the gradient of the inflaton scalar, as Claudia showed us. This one does not. And so you can define a new parameter that's the fraction of the power from the curvaton field. And that new parameter is going to depend on the mean value of the curvaton field, the fraction of energy density in the curvaton, and the slow roll parameter epsilon, which is just basically V prime over V. And we see that depending on the background value of the inflaton of the curvaton field, we can either have all of the fluctuations coming from the curvaton or practically none of them coming from the curvaton. One other thing I wanted to mention is that when we make the curvaton perturbations dominant, what we're doing is shoving the inflaton scalar perturbations to be very, very small. And since the tensor perturbations from inflation are always smaller than the inflaton scalar perturbations, we've pushed them to be even smaller still. So setting C approximately equal to 1 sends the tensor scalar ratio down to 0. So what are the constraints on the curvaton model? Does this work at all? So the two free parameters I've defined are this R, which is the fraction of the energy density in the curvaton, and C, the fraction of perturbations that come from the curvaton. Now remember that only the curvaton fluctuations are asymmetric. So with the power asymmetry is diluted by a factor of C. This leads to an upper bound, a lower bound, sorry, on C that rules out the yellow region here. And I plotted this for the 20% power asymmetry that's observed and for comparison of 5% power asymmetry. Now, the quadrupole I already mentioned rules out everything in red. And the final constraint comes from the non-Gaussianity. Remember that the potential fluctuation in this model is proportional to delta sigma plus delta sigma squared, which means it's a Gaussian fluctuation plus the square of a Gaussian fluctuation. That means it's very easily parameterized by F and L. And F and L in this theory is rather significant. Given the observational constraint of about upper bound of about 100, that rules out everything in blue. So there was great rejoicing, in my office at least, that there is a small allowed window here. Now, this is a logarithmic scale, so it's not as small as it looks. But there is a deal breaker. This window slams shut if F and L is constrained to be less than 50. And that's already going to be at the upper edge of acceptability in the next few years and will be definitively tested by the Planck satellite. So just quickly, I wanted to mention that now that we see that superhorizon fluctuation in the curvature field can explain the observed power asymmetry, where could this superhorizon fluctuation come from? I wanted it to be a quantum fluctuation. But unfortunately, the measured value of the power spectrum already determines what the RMS value of the curvature fluctuations are. And when you compare that measured value to the measured power asymmetry, and you put in all the constraints that go into determining that allowed window, you find that the required superhorizon fluctuation is at least a 5 sigma quantum fluctuation. So it must have a much more exotic origin. Two ideas that I wanted to just briefly mention is that it could be a signature of the so-called curvature web. The idea is that you, in the curvature model, if you have a long period of inflation, you end up with domains of different curvature values. And if we lived inside one such domain, you could see a gradient in the curvature field across our universe. On the other side, if you want a shorter period of inflation, then you can just say that this is a pre-inflationary remnant, that inflation didn't last much longer than 60 E-folds, and this power asymmetry could be interpreted as a signature that we're starting to see the first signs of the pre-inflationary era. Lastly, I mentioned some work that's in progress and where we're going from here in this model. So the asymmetry was originally detected for L between 5 and 40. What happens after 40 is a little bit more in dispute, but there are some analyses that see reduced asymmetry. The final word will probably have to wait a couple more years as JPL is working on it. So how could we make the asymmetry disappear at small scales? The answer comes from the fact that the inflaton perturbations are still statistically isotropic. So we can introduce scale dependence through this fraction C of how much the curvature contributes to the power. And there are two ways to do that. The first, the simplest, and I think the most unsightly, is to put in a feature in the inflaton potential. What this does is, since C depends on the slow roll parameter epsilon, if we're willing to decrease epsilon, we drive up the power spectrum from the inflaton, and decrease C. We also have to put in a drop in the inflaton potential itself so that we keep the scale, the power spectrum scale invariant. So you end up with an inflaton potential that looks something like this, and that's rather hideous. A more elegant solution that I'm currently working on is wondering if the asymmetry could be attributed to a small isocurvature component in the CMD. The curvature model produces isocurvature fluctuations very naturally. It doesn't require any work. In fact, if anything, it's more difficult to get rid of them than to keep them. And since isocurvature perturbations contribute more on large scales, having some of the asymmetry in the isocurvature perturbations will give it naturally the same diminishing importance on smaller scales. The question, of course, is, can this be made consistent with the already stringent upper bounds on isocurvature from the WMAP data? And that's something I'm working on at the moment. It looks like it possibly could work, but it's going to be tight. So to summarize, there is a power asymmetry in the CMB. It's detected on large scales, and it's present at the 99% confidence level. And what we wanted to ask was just simply, how difficult is it to create this thing during inflation? And the answer is, in single field inflation, it's extremely difficult. And that's because the superhorizon perturbation required to generate this much asymmetry is ruled out by quadrupole and octuple constraints on the CMB. However, a curvature perturbation is a viable source of the observed asymmetry. And this model has some definitive features. The superhorizon fluctuation is not a quantum fluctuation. It's more exotic than that. The simplest model gives an asymmetry that's scale invariant, but it may be possible to modify that. And then the two observational predictions that this proposal makes is a suppressed tensor scalar ratio, but more imminently testable is a high level of non-Gaussianity of FNL greater than 50, which will be definitively probed by the Planck satellite in the upcoming years. Thank you very much.
Yeah, so how serious is this? I mean, how confident are you that the single field inflation, which goes way, way, way beyond the horizon, is ruled out by
the simple answer to that is 99%, because there's a 1% chance this is just a statistical fluke. So,
but I mean, is this the death of single field?
No, I would say no. Like I said, there is an absolutely, about a 1% chance that this universe just was created this way.
This is cosmology. I mean, you guys are. I thought you're one. You're much better than 1%.
Unfortunately, because this is large scales, this is already cosmic variance limited. This isn't going to get any better with future CMB satellites. You can look for this asymmetry in the polarization, and that will help. If it shows up in the polarization in all frequency bands, that will make it more significant. But it's not going to get much better than at the 99% level. So more, I think, is the fact that we wanted to ask, how difficult is it to create this thing? And the answer is, it's very difficult. If you measure a high level of non-Gaussianity, like this metal demands, then single field vanilla inflation is already ruled out by that. If you measure non-Gaussianity below, an order unity, this model doesn't work anymore either. And then you really are pushed into just accepting that this thing is a statistical fluke, unless you can come up with something more creative than what we have here.
But I guess you have a very distinctive facial in principle, very, very difficult to probe, I guess. But the three-point function should hinder a little bit of the direction of this preferred direction, right? So
the four-point function definitely will. I don't know if it's sort of, you're saying with a three-point function, would you see it in the three-point function? You definitely see it. It leads to an anomalous four-point function. The three-point function is what is measured by FNL, and so that just comes from the curvaton model, not from the asymmetry. This is just a feature of the curvaton model with the parameters that we need in order to make the asymmetry work.
Yeah, but looking at the shape, really, FNL just gives you.
Right. This is all local type. You're asking about equilateral type as a way to distribute. I don't know 100% if you could find a signature of the asymmetry by looking at equilateral type non-Gaussianity. My gut says no, but I'm not 100% sure.
Sorry, I just missed the beginning of the talk. Apologies for that. The asymmetry is between the northern hemisphere and the southern hemisphere?
It's tilted with this, so like they kind of have this, the hemispheres roughly circle up there.
So it's pretty
severely tilted with respect to the galactic plane.
So I don't quite understand the picture. Should we dividing the sky in two?
Mm-hmm. Basically, yeah.
Let me
go back to one of the earlier slides here so you can see it. So basically, this is dividing the sky into along this plane, mm-hmm. and seeing that there's less power here and more power here.
So this is not, this is, the, you worry about a posteriori statistics at this point.
Right, about that this would.
Is that included in the 99%? Or?
Exactly how you go about including that is a little difficult. I mean, you generate simulated isotropic maps. You ask, how many of them have, some plane, not this plane, but any plane, that when I divide the hemispheres, I get this much asymmetry?
Yeah.
The answer is not many. Now, you're worried about,
That's not a good way to do it. You should have done this before the data.
Mm-hmm. but they didn't know that this was
exactly the end of it. You can't do it once you've done
no,
it.
No, it, you're right. When you
I think you should discount the 99%.
I agree. It's probably
maybe 95 or something.
The statistic, the specific hemispherical asymmetry is at the 99% level. When you think about all the anomalies that we could have seen but didn't, that's difficult to quantify, but probably should push it down a little bit.
So are you saying everything that models haven't predicted, we shouldn't believe if somebody sees it?
No, it's just if you see a weird effect. There's no model here, really. I mean, you're now making models, which might,
so
if there wasn't a model.
Right.
And
I think it makes it more,
you see strange things, you shouldn't be too concerned.
And I think
there's always strangeness in some respect.
And I think one of my motivations in looking at this was just asking, how strange is this?
Yeah.
Is this something that, if you had an anomalously large, the question I really wanted to answer was, if I had, say, a 2.5 sigma fluctuation in the inflaton field in the early universe that created the supervisor mode, could I explain this? The answer to that question is no. So it's difficult to explain by any sort of dynamical mechanism. I think that difficulty then makes me more willing to believe that it might be a statistical fluke, especially if the non-Gaussian V is measured to be less than 50. If it's measured to be greater than 50, I'm going to become a bigger fan of this model.
Right. So you here just basically assume a single mode, or to say turn on a single momentum.
Mm-hmm.
But if you do want to think about, suppose there are some really long wavelength fluctuation at the beginning, either quantum or something else, you may think that there's really shouldn't be just in a single direction.
Absolutely.
In all kinds of ways. I mean, maybe messing up in all kinds of ways. So have you tried to consider what would be the CMB signature for those kind of
models?
Oh, sorry.
So that's actually already been done.
Okay.
This is the Grishul-Kazeldovich effect. Excuse me, that Turner looked at in 91. It was looked at again with WMAP1 data by Castro et al. Just supposing a Gaussian field of superchiasmic fluctuations that turns on at some wavelength and then putting constraints on that size of that. That gets a little trickier in terms of, we need a gradient across the universe to explain this, and we want to break. We want to break statistical isotropy. That's the whole point. The bounds that we get from the CMB because of that are much weaker than the bounds that you get if you choose a, Gaussian random field. And that's because we can tweak things to make the quadrupole go away and then move us into the octuple.
Are you sure the instrument sensitivity didn't change?
The WMAP team actually has looked at this. I've talked to some of the folks from WMAP. They assure me that the satellite did not do anything wrong. That this is, WMAP is a very well understood satellite. Of course, when they first saw this too, they immediately started looking for systematic errors and systematic explanations. They couldn't find any.
But there's no other experiment that checks it.
I think I mentioned before you came in, Colby actually saw the same thing, albeit at less statistical significance because the error bars are so bigger. But Colby did see a power asymmetry along this axis at only about, the 80% statistical significance because the error bars were so much bigger.
If you plot the CLs for the two halves of the sky, what do they look like?
You can raise the blackboard.
Okay. Push it up.
I got a little space.
Another one.
Go again. Yes.
Okay. So this is in the Erickson 2004 paper. That's like the original paper that found this. And what you find is for L between 5 and 40, they didn't look higher, because it gets harder to judge the statistical significance at that point. They're doing that analysis. I wish they'd hurry up and finish it, but they're taking their time. They're going to have to forgive me. I can't really remember the, it's about maybe microprobe-ish. But this is L plus 1, C sub L. And basically, it looks something like know, there's quite a bit of scatter in one hemisphere, and then the other hemisphere, it's also a bit of scatter, but it is noticeably average value lower.
What's difficult about going to higher L?
So the way you test the statistical significance of this is generate thousands upon thousands of isotropic realizations of the Gaussian field. And the team at JKL tells me, at least, that this is computationally very intensive and very difficult.
But just measuring the CLs isn't.
Measuring the CLs is fine. Interpreting what that measurement means, how likely are you to get such a same thing from a background map that is statistically isotropic, is a more difficult question to answer.
Thank you, Adrian, again.